It's Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Good morning and welcome to Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff.
And I'm Kirk Colbert. Good morning, Casey.
Good morning, Kirk. Well, you were gone last week, but we covered this just briefly. But
Was I gone last week?
Yes, you were.
Oh,
but we want to get into a little bit more of this Amanda Knox story, because I know you've been following this story quite closely. We just hit on it a little bit in the last show, but there have been some continuing developments now. The ex-boyfriend of Amanda Knox is saying that he has returned to Italy to fight his new murder conviction. We say new because he was acquitted at one point, and then it was overturned, and now he's going back to face the music, as it were. Amanda Knox was home in the United States watching this retrial, and she was ultimately convicted, or at least I should say her, her
original
acquittal, her acquittal was overturned. Yeah. Which is something we don't have in the United States because we have, you know, double jeopardy laws. They don't have that in Italy.
Right.
And so now Amanda Knox, there's a lot of confusion over what's going to happen with Amanda Knox, because there's another appeal that's, I believe, being initiated, and that could take up to a year. And then if that goes into place, then Italy will certainly, and if her conviction gets upheld, Italy will certainly ask that she be extradited from the United States back to Italy. And the question then becomes, what does the United States do? Because we have an extradition treaty with Italy, and, you know, so do we violate that treaty and say, no, we're not going to extradite her back because of the perceived unfairness of this case? And they could do that. The United States government could do that, but that may cause some tumultuous times.
We'll talk about the case, but let me just jump to that point, because let me tell you why the United States probably will not do that, because we have a great need for Italy to honor our extradition requests to bring people back to the United States that are facing justice. Now, as it relates to extradition throughout the world, there are various aspects of the law that don't necessarily fall under a particular treaty provision. But one thing that does tend to happen in countries where they do not have, for example, the death penalty, and that's not an issue at all in the Amanda Knox case, but in terms of certain countries will refuse to extradite to the United States if the person is facing the death penalty, because those countries don't have the death penalty and they're philosophically opposed to it. Vice versa, we have situations where other countries do not have sufficient guarantees against injustice, where a person has not received what, you know, the United States views as some minimal amount of due process. I don't think that's a situation we're dealing with here. Now, this trial was a complete travesty when it comes to our American standards of justice and what does or does not constitute sufficient evidence of guilt. But let me just explain a little bit of the nuances of the Italian justice system. And I actually have studied this for years, not because of this case, but because of other interesting cases that have come up over the years. And I've read several books about how things work in Italy. But one could say that the Italian prosecution is a bit behind the times when it comes to their robustness of forensic science. And when you watch this trial as it's unfolded over the past, you know, several years, you can see that they're experiencing a lot of the pitfalls and problems with forensic science that I think we've tried to work through in the United States over the years, in terms of how opinion evidence can be transformed into scientific-like evidence. But just some features of the Italian justice system that might surprise you. First of all, the manner in which people are tried criminally in Italy is far different from how we have it here. Judges actually do sit on juries as well as citizens that they bring in, but they tend to be selected for this process. It's not like a jury of peers like we have here in the United States. We don't have 12 people that are brought in at random that are unfamiliar with the case necessarily. Secondly, the rules of evidence are quite different in terms of what can be introduced, and what is considered relevant is a much broader spectrum than what we have here in the United States. to summarize how we do it here so that people understand, we have a very limited view of what's relevant because things that are not relevant tend to be misleading. They may misguide the jury. They may introduce a prejudicial element to the case. Now, we don't mean prejudice in your common everyday meaning. What we mean is that it's something that may divert the attention away from the actual facts of the case. And it might be something that makes the person look bad. Now, in Amanda Knox's case, a lot of the evidence that was not quote-unquote forensic evidence, and we'll talk about that in a minute, but a lot of the evidence that was introduced at the original trial were things like the look on her face, how she was behaving, stuff she said.
And things she did afterwards, things she like did kissing afterwards. Her boyfriend afterwards, which right. seemed to me to be completely irrelevant. I mean, what relevance could that have to anything? I mean, I suppose they could try to argue it's her state of mind and she wasn't feeling any remorse, but you know, that was one of the things. Plus, they never in this case, they really never seem to have any motive
right.
on the part of Amanda Knox. Why would this happen? Why would she do this? And she maintains her innocence and has all along.
Again, in the United States, if you have a theory of prosecution where you say this was a sexual game that went awry and got out of control, and you know, three people participated in the rape and murder of this young woman. Well, you'd have to have, you know, some evidence to corroborate that. You'd have to have some evidence that actually placed her at the scene. You'd have to have, you know, other evidence of that motive that would come in. Otherwise, you're just plain shooting in the dark. And that's why we don't allow prosecutors to just say, hey, here's a story that might make sense. Let's take a stab at this. No pun intended. Yeah. But basically, the way that it works in Italy is that any sort of random idea that the prosecutor can come up with, it's almost like storytelling. And it's really interesting because, you know, it's trying to make all these pieces fit. Now, let's talk about the evidence in the case because there was blood all over this apartment. And there were basically two sources of the blood that they were able to identify. One, of course, was the victim, the young lady who had been killed. But also this this other individual, this young black man from Italy.
Who's sitting in prison right now,
right. With a much lesser sentence, by the way. His DNA was everywhere. His blood was everywhere. His DNA was actually inside the victim. So there's really no dispute that he was there and that he was involved in all this. But his story changed numerous times through the course of proceedings, and they latched on to him as a cooperator. And initially, his story was that he saw a silhouette inside the place when he was walking by, when he was trying to say that he was not involved. And he believed that the silhouette was, in fact, Amanda Knox, and that she was doing something that looked rather nefarious. Then his story changed to, yes, I was there, but these are the two people who were involved as well, although he never got that specific. And because of the fact that he was willing to take a deal, you know, in reality, it looks like he's the actual perpetrator here, and it looks like right. he's the one that may have acted alone, and probably did act alone, in my opinion, because then the prosecution had this bizarre theory that, you know, one man could not overpower one woman. Well, you know, that's kind of weird because that happens all the time, doesn't it?
Right.
And you know, this theory that all these other people were involved. It was also part of the argument in the original case that Amanda Knox had access to the apartment after the killing and therefore could have cleaned up all of her DNA, yet left the blood spattered evidence of the other individual all over the place, which is, it might fly in Italy, but that's not really forensically sound. That there was not one shred of Amanda Knox's DNA anywhere in that apartment that could have connected to the event. There was also the issue of this knife that was found at her boyfriend's house. Now, her story was that she spent the night at her boyfriend's house and was not there. She came the next morning, saw that there was some blood in the sink, thought, gee, that's weird, took a shower, got out of the shower, she's looking for a roommate, discovers that the door is locked from the inside, and then calls the police, and, you know, everything unfolds from there. But according to her, and, you know, it's what we would call an alibi in the United States. They don't view it quite that cleanly in Italy, but basically, as a result of the police being called and then an investigation that really didn't go that deep into the facts of the case, they end up arresting Amanda and her boyfriend and this other individual.
Well, and did you hear about the police that actually came upon the scene initially? They have essentially, my understanding in Italy, two different types of police. one type of police are sort of the higher ranking police that investigate the more serious crimes, and then you have the lower ranking police that investigate, you know, traffic tickets and things like that. Well, the traffic ticket cops, or the ones who investigate the lower level offenses, were the ones that came and essentially trampled all over the scene
right.
when they came on. So the way that the scene was, the murder scene, which is normally preserved, was not preserved well. So when you talk about forensic science,
right.
this is what we're talking about.
There was a bra clasp that was apparently ripped from a bra that when they did, you know, this is after trudging around the scene for many days, they ended up putting it in for forensic analysis, and there was a match, theoretically, to the boyfriend, his DNA, not Amanda Knox, but the boyfriend. And there was no dispute that the boyfriend had been at this apartment before. He had been dating Amanda Knox for roughly a week before this whole thing. But this is another interesting point. You would think that if somebody who lives in Italy and has been subject to the Italian justice system for presumably his whole life and would know how things work and had been dating somebody for a mere 7 days, that if he had the opportunity to cut a deal just like the other guy did, that he would have availed himself of that. But he has never implicated Amanda Knox in spite of their very brief relationship. It's hard to say, but you know, the Italian prosecution said they're sticking together because they're lovers and all this other stuff. Well, this is a 7-day relationship.
Right.
And
right.
certainly, you know, the ins and outs of this case are just dumbfounding. But we'll get into more of the problems associated with how this prosecution occurred and the history of the case, as it has now resulted in yet another conviction for Amanda Knox. But before we do all that, we're going to have to take a break, Casey.
All right. We'll be back with more Legal Defense in just a moment.
Now, back to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
And we're back with Legal Defense. Casey, we're talking about the Amanda Knox case and sort of the fallout from the most recent conviction, or I guess you could say reversal of acquittal, which was a reversal of a conviction. So
exactly.
You had mentioned before the break that in our American system of justice, as well as, you know, many other countries, we don't have repeated trials on the same events. And the idea is that, and it really makes a lot of sense philosophically when you think about it, because a person should not be subjected to repeated tries to convict a person. Now, why do you think that is? Is it just a matter of fairness, or is it a matter of the prosecution should only be given one chance? Or what do you think?
I think it's all of those things. I mean, I think that it's all of those things, because as a matter of fairness and as a matter of principle, if the government, which has numerous resources, almost endless resources, can come after an individual and prosecute them, well, then they ought to be held to their burden of proof. That's what we have in the United States. We have a burden of proof. It's on the prosecution. And it only makes sense that if the prosecution cannot meet that burden, and if a jury finds somebody to be not guilty, then for them to be subject to endless prosecution, because there is no double jeopardy in places like Italy, just strikes at the very heart of, I think, you know, our Constitution and what the founders thought about fairness, and you know, just not subjecting somebody to that kind of punishment. And that's what really gets me about this case, and that's what really is so unsettling about this case. I understand that we have an agreement with Italy, essentially, that we will extradite and they will extradite, you know, between the two countries. But it's very hard to look at this case when you have no motive, when you have all the problems that you have outlined in the previous segment, when you have all the forensic issues, when you have somebody who's already sitting in prison who looks like the guy who probably did, based on the evidence, commit this crime, And then you have Amanda Knox, who's been going through this ordeal for years. I mean, the first time she was convicted in 2009. We're now at 2014. How long can this go on?
Well, not only that, but she spent four years in an Italian prison waiting for the process to, you know, reverse itself.
So to me, I wonder about this because I know that we think about our justice system, and you and I talk about our justice system all the time. It's not without problems. It's not without flaws. And we have ways that we can fix it. But this seems to me just to strike at such an unfairness that you already have Amanda Knox's, one of her home state senators, coming out and in support of Amanda Knox, right? And although she didn't say it, it sounds like she's going to make a push to try to keep Amanda Knox here, even if her conviction is affirmed.
Right. It's interesting, though, because one thing that I don't think will be part of this analysis is I think we as Americans viewing this process see the profound flaws in the Italian process. And look, it's not because, you know, they call her Foxy Noxy or any of this other garbage. It's because of the problems with the case. However, you know, that's not really part of the equation. And it probably can't be, unfortunately. We can't second guess other countries' justice systems that have, and frankly, this one's been around longer than ours. And the fact that they have their own procedures that result in a lot of convictions, where does it end there? Because are we going to start chiming in and saying, hey, look, this other case that didn't involve an American citizen, you didn't properly convict this person. We, as outsiders, believe that it was an incorrect conviction.
That, but what about places like Iran and places like North Korea?
We do take a different approach in those types of cases, and we do have different policies with regard to extradition, and we do chime in when there is a problem with regard to how a conviction was obtained. But let me go back to your comments on double jeopardy and just add one more point to this, because I'm going to tie two concepts together here. Now, you've done many trials before, and you know that it's traditional at the beginning of a trial that the judge orders something called sequestration. And the purpose behind that is that once the trial starts, jeopardy attaches. In other words, it's the prosecution's chance to do things. It's recognized by virtue of this sequestration rule that as people testify, it is possible for them to change or warp their testimony so it matches other prosecution witnesses. It's also possible for the prosecutor to help the witnesses along and say, hey, look, this other guy testified in this way, and it would be very helpful for the prosecution if you also said this or whatever. It acknowledges the fact that there are subtleties in how people can phrase things, remember things, and it also, by the way, once a trial starts, the dynamics of how the defense proceeds starts to change, because right up until the trial starts, right up until the jury is sworn, in our country anyway, the defense does not have to reveal a whole lot about how the defense is going to occur. There are certain affirmative defenses where the defense is required to give advance notice. An example would
be alibi.
Right. Another example would be certain forms of self-defense, although not all self-defense. There are certain types of cases, duress, coercion, things like that, where the discovery obligation on the part of the defense is slightly different than what it normally is. What it normally is that there is none, and that you don't have to tell the prosecutor exactly what you plan on doing or how it ends up unfolding. The idea being, as you touched on, the government has infinitely greater resources when it comes to investigating these things. And let's face it, if they had access to all of the defense witnesses and if they had access to all the defense evidence, they would be able to tear it apart by more aggressive investigation. We acknowledge the fact that the police have greater persuasive authority on lay witnesses than perhaps private investigators do. And it acknowledges this general concept that once the trial starts and once the prosecution starts learning more about the defense, there would be an opportunity to either influence those people's testimony. It's not so much of a test of what the person remembered, but as we all know, and especially in systems whereby they use old, outdated, arcane interrogation techniques like they do in Italy, and we'll get to that. But, you know, the evidence can change. And that's one reason why we want to have the prosecution have one fair shake at getting a conviction. And if they fail to do so, then that's it. They can't do it again, because now we're not really involved with justice anymore. Now it's a matter of, you know, who wins. But let's talk about how the interrogation in this case played an important role. Amanda was very young when she first went to Italy. On she was there to study, she had a rudimentary understanding of Italian, enough for conversational, like, you know, where can I get myself a pizza and a biscotti and that kind of thing. And unfortunately, as young people are prone to do, she tried her very best to converse with everyone in Italian and not in English. That included during the interrogation, unfortunately, because she thought, well, hey, I'll try out my Italian speaking skills here when I'm trying to. Now, one very important thing happened in the course of this interrogation. And, you know, just by way of background, she also ended up inadvertently, I'm not going to say inadvertently, but I think the police latched on to this. She implicated her her boss that worked at a like a coffee shop that was there in Italy. And the way that this happened is that there were hours and hours of interrogation. It was the old style interrogation that we don't really use anymore, like, you know, getting in her face, whacking her in the head a few times, telling her exactly what the story was, and repeatedly trying to get her to agree to it. It turns out that there was a text message that she sent to her boss when she was done working. And what she said was, "See you later." Okay. Now, what does that mean to you? You live here in America. What is, hey, Casey, see you later. What does that mean?
See you later. I'm leaving.
Yeah. I'm it means it's kind of like goodbye, isn't
right.
it? It doesn't mean I'm actually going to see you later,
right.
does it?
Well, not necessarily.
But in Italy, if you were to say, see you later, that means I'm going to actually see you later today. Okay. So they use this as a way to say, aha, you had plans to meet up with your boss because you said, see you later. She's trying to explain herself in Italian. Okay. And says, no, that's just something we say in America. Like, well, why would anybody say that in America? See you later if you're not going to see the person later. Why would you say that? That doesn't mean goodbye. If you meant goodbye, you'd say ciao. You wouldn't say see you later, but you said see you later. See?
So it's essentially a
cultural difference, and it's just a nuance of a phraseology, if you want to look at it that way. Well, then, you know, eventually she just wanted the interrogation to stop. It had been going on and on and on. She said, yes, my boss was there. Well, they go and arrest him. He's got, you know, 37 witnesses that can establish his alibi. He gets held in custody while they're investigating this whole thing. And then they end up saying, well, she lied, saying that you were there. So number one, that means that she's guilty because she implicated this other person based on this see you later text message, which they still didn't believe her story that means goodbye or see you tomorrow or take it easy or whatever. And then on top of that, they added another charge to the trial, and she was convicted, and now she's been convicted again, of basically a criminal version of slander that they have in Italy, that if you implicate another person or say somebody's done something illegal or wrong, that there's a criminal charge that's associated with that, along with some civil liability. So she's been found guilty to have done that as well. But basically, this is like a combination of the kangaroo court and the star chamber that we have here, because it's really just forcing the issue. And all of the evidence comes down to all these bizarre little things like, oh, she was kissing her boyfriend, or she had a smile on her face, or she didn't act like she was grieving. There was another component of the case that they thought was fairly significant. You know, this is probably more a function of her being a young person that really didn't grasp the severity of the situation and certainly didn't have any understanding of the Italian justice system. But she, while she was being held, they took a break where they were going to get her some water, and she was stretching her back, and she like did some sort of split where she was like stretching. And, you know, the way that it was reported by one of the interrogators is that she was doing cartwheels. I mean, she didn't do cartwheels, but because she did a split, the story kind of went from person to person, sure, to person to person. And they had her doing all these cartwheels and backflips and somersaults and stuff in the interrogation room, like she was jumping for joy over the death of her roommate, which that isn't what happened. But this is the type of evidence that was used to convict her. Now, the initial process of the trial itself, and then the initial appeal, which went to an appellate court. Now, they have basically a trial de novo that then, and it starts all over again and happens all the way through, and there's no restriction on what the government can or can't do. They can have an entirely different theory of prosecution. They can call different witnesses. They're not really bound by their previous thing, but Yes, it'll be interesting to see if this takes yet another turn and yet another trial, because there's really no limitation on how many times this can happen, believe it or not.
Well, and Kirkin, that was we will certainly follow this story. When we get back, we're in the midst of the Winter Olympics in Sochi, and so we will talk about something that happened in the Winter Olympics years ago with Nancy Kerrigan and Tanya Harding. When we get back with more Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey.
It's Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
And welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff.
And I'm Kirk Colbert. What else we got?
Well, Kirk, the Nancy Kerrigan, Tanya Harding scandal. You remember this?
That was a long time ago,
20
dude.
Years ago, this was. Right. But the reason it's being brought up again
Were you born yet? Yeah, you were.
Yes, I was long past born. There were many things there that were very, very interesting. And I remember it in a very weird way, because you were sort of, it was almost like you had, you know, Tanya Harding was kind of like the evil villain, and then Nancy Kerrigan, of course, was the, you know, the princess, America's sweetheart, and it had this type of story where I understand how media sort of latched onto this whole thing, because it really had sort of the, you know, the ice princess versus, you know, it was
the
one
evil
of those
ice things. Queen.
The evil ice queen, right. So it was one of these things, and if you don't remember it, this was essentially somebody came out of nowhere and whacked Nancy Kerrigan in the knee right before the Olympics, which they thought was going to keep her out of the Olympics. But in fact, what ended up happening is she got the silver medal, I think, and then Tanya Harding was left out of the ring. Well, they didn't know who did this, and they tried to find out who did it. It turned out that Tanya Harding's then boyfriend was linked to it, had planned it with Tanya Harding's bodyguard, and then Tanya Harding had denied and still denies, I believe, her involvement in this whole thing, although she did say that she knew it was going to happen, so I don't know if you can say she really wasn't involved. And at some point, she was convicted. This was over in Lillehammer in Norway, and she was convicted of essentially their version of impeding the prosecution or the investigation, obstructing type of offense, although it wasn't called that. So now things are coming out about this whole thing. She pled guilty to a conspiracy to hinder prosecution. And she then did admit that she knew after the fact that about the NEWAC plan, but didn't come forward to authorities.
The NEWAC plan.
Yeah. And the ESPN recently did a feature on this on their network that was really interesting, because it really delved into the entire story of these two individuals. You know, both of them come from sort of blue-collar backgrounds. Tanya Harding came from a blue-collar background, but had a lot of, I believe she was abused as a child, and she had a very traumatic childhood. Nancy Kerrigan also came from a blue-collar background, but she had really no problems with it. She just sort of rose to be this fantastic skater that she was. And part of it gets you to, at a point in the beginning, feel somewhat sympathetic to Tanya Harding, not because if she had anything to do with this, but just based on her family background. And what it brought to mind to me, Kirk, is there are many people who make mistakes, and you and I see this on a regular basis and in the profession that we're in, and some of them are not guilty. Some of them may have made a mistake that they regret, but it's bringing that story to light that is part of what you and I do every day and part of what we enjoy, because there's far more to one person than a single mistake, and it could be a very bad mistake or a very bad decision that they made at one point in their lives. But when you go and you examine the totality of their lives, you don't want that to define them for the rest of their lives. And that's part of the reason why we
have... Well, I think Tanya Harding has been defined for the rest of...
She has
Well, they both have been defined by this incident for the remainder
of their lives.
They have. But, you know, Tanya Harding's on some of those shows on, what is it, True TV? Have you seen
that? Yeah, I think you're right. She's is on some of those.
She's with a bunch of other people like Todd Bridges and Leif Garrett and a bunch of other has-beens.
But I mean, her life was ruined by this. And some would say, well, understandably so, because she knew about this and she didn't do anything to prevent it. And it was a terrible time in her life. But at the same time, and I'm not excusing her behavior at all. You look
kind
at this.
Kind of sounds like you are, but go ahead.
Well, no. You look at this and you go, okay, yes, this is an awful thing. There's no excuse for what she did. But at the same time, her life shouldn't be defined as this because she has done other good things in her life. And I think that as a society, we like to think of redemption in the sense as if somebody does do good things, their past mistakes, although not forgotten, can be sort of forgiven.
Well, I think one reason why this caught so much national attention, obviously it has to do with, you know, Olympic competition and that sort of thing, but it also seems to be, you know, more evidence of the fact that the Olympics are turning into, you know, cutthroat competition, which goes so far beyond the spirit of what the Olympics are supposed to represent, which is, you know, if you really boil it down, it's supposed to be people that have worked very hard within their particular area of sports specialty to achieve an amateur level of perfection. With that, you know, and it's always been the spirit, although I know we've whittled that down quite a bit over the years, that it should be people that are not involved in professional sports. I know they changed that rule quite some time ago because now we see the Kobe Bryants and so forth that are involved in actual Olympic events. But, you know, I think this is sort of the start of the very dark era of the Olympics. Well, not the start, because there were pretty bad things that happened in the Olympics preceding this, including, you know, people getting killed and that kind of thing. But, you know, as far as the competition rising to such a level where people would engage in criminal conduct to try and get the upper hand. So it's a combination of how it reflects the lost innocence of the Olympics, but also the fact that if somebody had such poor taste to not win fair and square, but by actually engaging in criminal conduct that could theoretically have taken away, robbing somebody else of their physical ability to pursue her own dream. I think that's why it was so shocking at the time it happened. Yeah, and somebody knew what they were doing. Somebody knew that they were whacking her knee for a very good reason.
I mean, plus we had the video of the why after she was hit and all of that. So it was dramatically, played up in the media and for good reason. There was another story. When you talk about forgiveness, one of our one of the attorney general candidates, Brad Schimmel, who we've talked about on the show before, who's the only Republican currently in the race for attorney general. Waukesha County DA. He came forward about a drunk driving conviction, first offense, non-criminal, from years ago, over 20 years ago. And in that sense, he talked about it, and his opponents have jumped on that, essentially as you would expect them to. But I think really in poor taste, this was over 24 years ago. This is something.
Yeah, I think he's playing this exactly right. I mean, it is what it is. You can't change it. There's no sense trying to hide it. There's no sense trying to make excuses. And I think it's actually a very bad idea for his opponents to be latching on to this because, you know, he's really taken the high road here. And it seems like more of a cheap shot in that you're trying to define people from, you know, their past conduct again.
And he's the more, you know, he seems to, at least on this issue, is being very genuine about it. And they released details to the newspaper last week or the week before about this particular incident where he got pulled over, and there was some allegation initially that because he was going so quickly and then pulled over after the officer, you know, turned on his red and blues, that there was some allegation of eluding. And Brad Schimmel, of course, had denied that, essentially saying he didn't see the officer behind him. But it's getting to the point now where it's being picked apart so much, and, you know, negative inferences are being drawn to this story from all over.
It's really distracting from the issue.
It's really distracting from the issue. And Brad Schimmel has an important point to make on this, which is to say that a first offense, drunk driving, ought not be a criminal offense. And he's not necessarily saying that, by my calculation, because of his first offense.
Although that would be an easy
connect the dots, but he's making valid points about the cost of this whole thing, the fact that it would be very difficult to prosecute. He talks about the apples and oranges approach with Wisconsin, where prosecutors are required to seek convictions in all drunk driving cases, versus other states like Illinois, where you can get the charge dismissed if you are in good behavior for a long enough period of time. So he's making, I think, the correct points in defending why first offense drunk driving ought not to become a crime in Wisconsin, unless, of course, we have these types of diversion programs that allow for cases like this to be dismissed if somebody demonstrates good behavior and sobriety, because that's, after all, the whole point of this thing. And he's still going to be attacked by this, and has been attacked, and probably will be throughout the campaign. But even Ishmael Ozan, one of the Democratic Attorney General candidates who's running, has admitted that he had some type of alcohol-related incident in his past, although the records have been purged since then.
Well, a bit of good news is that because of these revelations, the mayor of Toronto has agreed to assist Brad Schimmel in his campaign. No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, has he?
Just kidding.
He's coming on as a campaign advisor. Yeah. The mayor of Toronto might be the epitome of what you don't want to do when you're running for office.
What I do in my own time, office, including using illegal drugs and everything else, is none of your business.
Yeah. So we don't have anything quite approaching that with the Attorney General's race in Wisconsin. But I just think it's an interesting play, because perhaps now, rather than trying to hide it, because I think we're in this realm where people can go on the internet, they can find out, you know, they can find out a lot more than they used to be before. There really are no secrets. And you're not going to go back to this time where you have flawless candidates. There are going to be, every candidate I would submit to you in the race has some type of flaw in their background. Some are bigger than others. Some are more substantive than others. Some may disqualify that candidate from running for office. But each of them have that. So perhaps the strategy of getting out in front of the train before it runs you over is a good one.
Well, you know, and you raise another point that I think applies to a good philosophy in life, which is if you never make mistakes, or at least if you don't have the opportunity to learn from those mistakes, then you don't grow. You don't become a better person as a result of it. And it could be said, logically speaking, that someone who has been through the actual process of having been arrested for drunk driving is probably in a better position to comment on what the state of the law is and what we should be doing as a society than someone who has, for whatever reason, you know, probably through their own good conduct, avoided that. But, you know, it does give somebody a different perspective, and one that's probably valuable.
Absolutely. Well, we do have to take a break. We'll be back with a final segment of Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey in just a moment.
You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey.
And I'm Kirk.
All right, Kirk. So the Milwaukee County Sheriff's Office reported...
Oh, no, not again.
And this was back on January 30th, but we haven't gotten to this yet, that a male correctional officer is being investigated after a camera was discovered in a woman's locker room. In the women's locker room. Sheriff David Clark ordered an investigation after a female correctional officer reported that she saw a man exiting the women's locker room. The investigation turned up a wireless camera... this according to WISN.com, after a female correctional officer, or a wireless camera in the women's locker room, as well as recording equipment in the men's locker room. A spokesperson for the Sheriff's Department said the correctional officer has been employed at the department since 2008 and was removed for termination in 2011 for harassment of female employees. The spokesperson said that Sheriff Clark recommended the termination, but that ruling was overruled by the personnel review board.
Wait. The suspect is somebody who had previously been disciplined for harassing female employees.
Apparently.
Okay. And this is the suspect.
Yeah,
this apparently is the person who was seen leaving the ladies' locker room?
Yes.
Okay. Go ahead.
So, they recommended termination, but that ruling was overruled by the personnel review board, and the officer was instead suspended. Detectives have arrested the man, and the sheriff said the investigation is...
Well, see what happened here? First, he gets caught harassing female employees, and they say, don't harass female employees anymore. And he stopped.
So I'll just videotape them.
I'll just videotape them without them knowing it. That way I'm not harassing them, right?
It's amazing. Yes.
It's still wrong, a little bit pervy and a little bit weird. Well, but, that way they don't know about it.
There was a scandal back at the high school that I attended many years ago involving a camera that was put into the men's locker room.
Oh, dear.
And that camera was learned to have been placed there by, I believe, some school personnel because they were worried about theft in the locker room. And so this caused a huge uproar because, of course, you know.
See what happens with all this technology? It just creates more problems. They were trying to do something good, but it turned – or at least they were trying to utilize – you know, when was this? This was in the 90s early 2000s when you were in high school?
No, stop it.
Oh, okay. And they had these new camera things, these newfangled things. Back when I was in school, they didn't have such nonsense. In fact you know, I don't think we even had theft back then. It hadn't been invented. No, I'm just kidding. But
they called it stealing.
They called it stealing.
Did you know that there was actually Wisconsin, I believe, if I recall correctly, when I used to look in the old statute books from, you know, the early 1900s, they didn't call it theft. They actually called it stealing.
Stealing, right.
Yes. You were charged with stealing.
Yeah.
So it was just a different terminology. But I just found that funny. It would be sort of like calling something fisticuffs.
Fisticuffs.
Right?
You're charged with getting in fisticuffs.
Yeah. You know, that
which means getting in a fight, right?
Right. That's like Kirk's version of, you know, fast talking high pants guy. Whatever.
What do you mean fast talking high pants guy? She? That's what I'm talking about. See,
there you go. One of Kirk's many good impressions. All right. So now this story from the Journal Sentinel that I wanted to talk about. Wisconsin's law on police accountability and custody deaths goes unused. We've had this law on the books that essentially allows prosecutors to charge police officers if there is an in-custody death that was, you know, done with some type of impropriety or negligence or recklessness or something of that nature. So this story goes on to say Myron Weston told a healthcare provider at the Milwaukee Secure Detention Facility that he had tried to kill himself 6 times, all of them by drinking cleaning fluid and taking pills, but that didn't stop officials from letting him work as a janitor. 6 months after revealing his previous suicide attempts, Weston made another one, drinking window cleaner. No one noticed, even though he was housed on a unit for mentally ill and infirm prisoners and was supposed to be closely monitored. And despite the information in his prison medical record, neither the guards nor medical staffers put the pieces together when Weston got sick. They allowed his condition to deteriorate for 3 days before taking him to the hospital. By then, it was too late. He ended up dying. Part of the defense,
like, yeah, we don't know. He died being a janitor,
right.
I guess. I don't know.
Exactly. And part of the defense here was, okay, the correctional officers didn't know about his condition of having consumed, you know, this type of liquid in the past because of HIPAA regulations. They weren't allowed to know that information. So this brings to mind the state law that was designed specifically to hold law enforcement accountable when prisoners die. That was just passed 30 years ago. But no one in Milwaukee County or anywhere else in the state has been charged with violating it for more than 20 years, according to a Journal Sentinel review of online court records, which date back to 1992. In Milwaukee County, Deputy District Attorney Kent Laverne said he could not recall the charge being issued in the 10 years before that either. Jailers who neglect sick prisoners are rarely disciplined. When they are, the punishments are often overturned. And this goes on to cite numerous different deaths that have occurred over the years and where, you know, essentially there have been no charges. You may recall the case recently where the young man died in the back of the squad car in Milwaukee County, and he was essentially gasping for air, screaming for help, those types of things. There was a John Doe investigation that you and I talked about where the John Doe jury recommended charges, but the special prosecutor said, I can't prove it, and so nobody was charged.
You know, it's interesting that we do have laws that are created for good purposes, and this was not put on the books 30 years ago for the purpose of making it harder for corrections officers to do the jobs, but it does reflect an important value that we have in society, and that is that when we have unique circumstances where people are subject to different conditions than normal everyday life, a duty of care can rise to the point where there should be criminal liability for failing to follow that. There's an old case from 1943 called United States versus Dottweiler, and it has to do with a guy that was the CEO of a pharmaceutical company. And what was happening was he was in charge of the company's operations, and completely unbeknownst to Mr. Dottweiler, there was changing of labels that was going on, and there for adulterated pharmaceuticals that were being distributed. And mislabeling, essentially, is what it is. So inferior products were being labeled as having ingredients or purity that they didn't actually have. An investigation revealed that this was something that was being done by much lower level management in efforts to meet quotas and things like that, and essentially hiding it, attempting to hide it from the CEO of this company. Well, he was found criminally liable based on a violation of a federal law, which does attach criminal liability to somebody who's in a position of ultimate responsibility. Okay, it, almost like in the military, where the commander, the colonel, the general, whomever is in charge of an entire unit, is responsible for all the misdeeds of that unit, whether he or she engages in them himself or not. Because this idea of accountability—you have to be able to answer to the public, you know, even to the level where it's criminal liability. If you don't do everything within your power, and even if you do everything within your power, and it still results in harm to others because of the unique circumstances that it faces. So the lesson to be gleaned from that, I know I'm getting back into old Supreme Court case law from the 1940s, which is kind of my thing, you know.
Right.
But anyway,
that's what you like to do.
That's my thing. That's what I do on the weekends,
right,
man. But anyway, the idea, and it's a very interesting decision, because the Supreme Court acknowledges that there is no reason to hold somebody personally liable other than the fact of the position that he holds with the company. And that requires, and basically, if something goes wrong, who bears better, who's in a better position than the CEO of the company, the person in charge, the president, the one to make sure that these types of things don't happen. So an analogy here is drawn to this type of law, where things happen within the confines of a jail or prison, and the person has a very limited voice and very limited recourse to make sure that their safety is intact. So we impose extra, I guess, super liability, if you want to put it that way, beyond just financial, with the possibility of criminal liability if a person is not adequately protected because they are an extremely vulnerable person. It also impacts, this is another thing why it's so important. You might say, oh, it's unfair because they didn't know this or they didn't know that. Well, it's part of their job to take those types of things seriously. And not only does it affect the safety of individual people that are within the prison system, but it affects the integrity of our entire justice system. Because when people start hearing about guards that are not doing enough to make sure that people don't die in their custody, it affects the public's view on the righteousness or whether or not it's proper to even have people in custody. And when judges order people to not have bond and to wait trial while not being released, they have to take into account the fact that they could die if they're not being cared for properly. So that affects the public's trust in judges. It affects the public's trust in whether or not the very conditions of bond and whether or not cash bond is going to protect somebody. And it affects the victims of a crime that may have to come and testify, knowing that if the judge is reluctant to keep somebody in custody because people are dying because this law isn't being followed, then people at large are at risk. See, the sky is falling. I'm like,
exactly.
Chicken Little.
Well, and this story goes on to point out that focusing on the manner of death is missing the point, according to Fred Cohen, a retired law professor who served as an independent monitor in several federal cases involving prisoners' civil rights. Instead, officials should be asking, was this death preventable? Weston's death, Cohen said, clearly was. He said, quote, "This is as bad as anything I've ever heard." He said of the decision to let Weston work with cleaning products, not only did they know he was suicidal, they know how he did it, and they gave him the very agent that he's used to try to commit suicide. That sounds criminal, according to Fred Cohen, retired law professor. So
I agree with Fred.
With that, we do have to end the show for today, but remember, you can join us every Saturday morning from 8 to 9 right here on 1330 WHBL. This has been another edition of Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. Have a great weekend.